Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in May 2025. Now today we're discussing ultra-processed foods, and as the debate over the pros and cons of UPFs continues to rage, our expert panel cuts through the misinformation to explore what's really driving public concern about food processing.
It's an absolute privilege to invite such incredible speakers here today. We have Professor Giles Yeo, MBE from Cambridge University, accredited and registered nutritionist Rob Hudson. We've got Matt McCumberth from Plant and Futures Director and Complete Food Group. We've got Leo Campbell, co-founder of Modern Baker, and Anthony Warner, acclaimed chef and writer. So we've got so much to talk about. Last year, when we were here talking about the UPF debate, it was very, very kind of stuck in its ways. And since then, we know that it's evolved to be far more nuanced. But the discussion is going nowhere. So I think we could be here for a while. So I'm going to try and keep the questions fairly synced. And then I'll invite then everyone to ask questions if they want to at the end. And we'll be around if you want to ask further questions throughout the day. So without further ado, I'm going to start off just by asking you, in quite a short way, if you can just introduce yourself and why the ultra-processed food debate topic has brought you here today. I'm going to start with Robert. I'll start from the end and walk across then.
Yes, so I'm Rob Hobson, a registered nutritionist. I work as a freelancer, but I've written a few books on UPFs. And yeah, I think it's brought me here today because I'm just really interested in this topic, but from the perspective of how to help people to really understand UPFs, because like you said, it's really nuanced, it's really confusing, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So yeah, just helping to guide people through that, how to navigate that whole UPF landscape.
Excellent, yep. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Matt McCauley. I'm the Brand and Futures Director at the Complete Food Group, so look after all the brands from Squeaky Bean to Badass Wars, but also the future side of things, which is why I'm here today, making sure that we stay in touch with health. And I think my position on this is more around health rather than UPF. And I'm kind of more interested in ensuring that we eat a more healthy and sustainable and delicious diet going forwards rather than get hyper-focused on UPF.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Giles Yeo. I'm at the University of Cambridge, where I'm an obesity scientist. So I'm interested in why people are small, medium, and large, and the environment we live in. But broadly, I study the brain influences of feeding behavior. So I am actually interested in health, and I guess how UPF fits. A, what is UPF? But how UPF fits within this concept of a healthy diet, which is why I'm here.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Leo Campbell, founder of Modern Baker. We 6 years ago, our team sat down and posed the question to ourselves, what if it were possible to make a healthy UPF? So we spent the last 6 years backed by Innovate UK 6 grants and some private funding, working with multiple university labs and industry partners towards that goal. Basically, you look at an apple, why isn't it the sugar bomb that it should be? So what's in that isn't in the food system, and can we replicate that as best we can? And last year we launched Superloaf into M&S and Sainsbury's, made for us by Hovis under license, and it has a low GI profile, made on the same high-speed machines that make industrial loaves. So that's how we come into this, and we have a different view on it, which is the grocer called Superloaf the world's first healthy UPF, and we'll take that because I think that's the only way out of this.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Anthony Warner. I'm a development chef by trade. I'm also a writer. I've written some books, and I think I've been writing about UPF since before it was cool, back in sort of when it started first being introduced into Brazilian dietary guidelines. The reason that it's a really an area of interest for me is, you know, I work and our consultancy works to create healthier and more sustainable foods. And if we want to do that, we do need ways of measuring how healthy and how sustainable foods are. And we currently have a sort of nutrient profiling model and HFSS. I think that's fine but flawed. And so I'm interested in alternatives, and UPF classification system and ANOVA classification system is one way of doing that. I personally don't believe, and anyone who's read anything I've written about this subject will know, I don't believe it's a good way of doing that, and we need alternatives. But I'm really interested in this debate and talking about it, because I think we need to discuss better ways of moving forward rather than just the complete divisions we have at the moment, or people who are for the UPF system and people like me who are anti it.
Thank you so much. So as you say, it's so nuanced. And actually, for anyone that's unfamiliar, I'm sorry, I didn't say to begin with, UPF is ultra-processed food. And so it's been banded around and used very, very frequently, which nicely comes on to our next question, in that the public seem to be very concerned about processing because it's been thrust upon them, not necessarily something new. Why do you think it's at an all-time high? And as you're saying about misinformation, how do we cut through that noise? So if I start with yourself as well, Rob, because you were talking about misinformation, how would you tackle that?
Yeah, I think we need more. There's a lot of people involved in that UPF conversation that are in it for the wrong reasons, especially on social media, either to get followers or to get attention. So I think we do need to find a way of just get more experts actually talking about it. But first of all, we kind of need to understand the topic ourselves a bit more. You know, we need more research to really understand exactly what's going on, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, and I think also, you know, helping people to navigate that as well. Things like teenagers who are exposed to all of this, teaching them critical thinking so they can really sort of think more clearly about what it is, the information that they're getting and taking on board from this. So, yeah, I think there just needs to be more of a science-led conversation and not listening to influencers so much.
Which leads lovely on, if I can now pose that to Giles, with the research that's around ultra-processed food, how do you find that can transfer into the public domain? And where's the sticking points? That's probably a very long question.
Well, no, I think the biggest sticking point is the definition of UPF, which we can get to, right? Because ultimately, certainly within the big umbrella that is UPF at the moment, there's certainly some foods we should eat less of. I'm not a bad food, good food type of human being. I think there are foods we can eat a lot of, and I think there are foods we should eat less of. And undoubtedly, within the broad UPF umbrella, there are foods we should eat less of. So the moment you begin to do science and say, oh, okay, well, is UPF bad for you in an epidemiological setting, for example, invariably the answer is going to come out as yes, because you're taking a lot of foods in there you should eat less of. So how do you take that nuance, though, okay, of which there's this big umbrella? And UPFs are interesting because they kind of sit where a lot of other things, clean eating, for example, previously, and then suddenly they were anti-fat people, anti-carb people. I think where we are at UPF at the moment is that it reflects the hysteria around nutrition whenever we talk about it. So I think we need to sort of dial everything back and look at what the nuance actually is, particularly with the science, because in there is some truth. Okay, which are the foods that are not so good for us? Why are they not so good for us? And that's what we need to unpick. With hysteria, we're not going to get there, because then people are going to, the moment I say anything like this, I'm funded by Big Food. I'm not funded. I realize I'm speaking to Big Food, but that's not the point. But I'm not. I really do want to know what's healthy and what is less healthy.
Yeah. And Anthony, to yourself, obviously writing and you're communicating, how are you finding that?
Yeah. that's fun, isn't it? I think, nuance is important, but nuance is the enemy of marketing in many ways. People want simple solutions. People want to be told what to eat and what not to eat. And, you know, unfortunately, the answer to that is probably complicated and it's probably context dependent. And anyone who tells you it's simple is almost certainly trying to sell you something, whether that's a diet or a product or a supplement or something ridiculous like that. So, yeah, it is a very difficult thing, because what we are trying to get across as communicators is that sort of nuance and complexity, and say it's not as simple as this is bad, this is good, and all UPFs, you know, that's just not the way things are. And you're trying to get a complex message across, which is very difficult and takes a lot of effort. There's a famous law in communication, and I won't swear, just in, but it says that... I'll swear. Which is that the energy required to produce bullshit is an order of magnitude less than the energy required to refute it. So you know, and that's kind of what happens in communication, is that you're coming across a very simple message and you're trying to debunk it and show people why it's more complicated, and that's really, really difficult and takes an enormous amount of time and is kind of difficult to make it to an interesting communication message. So yeah, that's kind of where I am at the moment with communicating about UPF. But I still think it's a really important battle. It's probably the most important thing to do, is to define which foods we want people to eat more of and which foods we want people to kind of move away from. And that sort of lack of nuance in UPF, I think, is problematic in the desire to do that.
Thank you. So I'm going to now come on to Leo and ask you, so can we make ultra-processed food healthier? I think you kind of addressed that in your introduction. But if you could expand a little bit on what you're really tackling to make it healthier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's our belief. And we work with, we've got a lab up at Newcastle University in the Cell and Molecular Biosciences Department. And it's demonstrably correct. However, it sits outside all of the goodness and all of the impact sits outside HFSS and the nutrient profiling model, because demonstrably they don't work. That's actually the problem. So, I mean, if we take a step back, you ask the question about why is the public talking about this so much now? It's because you would have thought that the traffic light system, the nutrient profiling model and the definition of UPS should all be proxies for each other. They should all overlap and match perfectly. And when you've got a can of Coca-Cola with three green traffic lights and Diet Coke with four, you realize that actually everybody's confused. These systems don't work. And, you know, and that's what's wrong. So in order to make healthy ultra-processed foods, or probably better framed by saying how we can fix the problem, because ultra-processed foods are not going away. We have to feed people cheaply now, reliably and effectively. So they're not going away. So the question is how the only way we can actually fix them is to start redefining what we mean by healthy. And that is all about what actually happens in human biology in the body of a human being at the various points through digestion, not in a test tube 30, 40 years ago that gets the point system given to it and then added together in a linear manner to give you a very, very simplistic score that has nothing to do with what makes that apple not a sugar bomb, which is about, you know, you put two ingredients together and the synergies just explode. Put 10 ingredients together, high-impact nutrients together, they explode further. Put, you know, polyphenol-rich elements into that, as well as start optimizing the fibers towards the viscous and soluble and fermentable ones, it starts going off the scale. Then when you ferment that mixture, you can amplify all of the benefits still further whilst keeping the intervention relatively small. So in Superloaf, our intervention is about 14% in dry weight. Our next generation blend is 7% in dry weight. And the rest of the chassis of the product is the simple standard Hovis Pride flour, the white flour. So we're not relying on the chassis doing any of the job at all. The intervention is doing everything. And I can talk about that if you want, actually what's happening in the human body, maybe in a different question.
That'd be super. We'll come back to that if that's okay. And Matthew, with yourself, and how is your company and business tackling this?
Yeah, I think, look, I want to bring this back to a balanced diet because it's really, really simple. And what worries me is we are making this really confusing. Now, I've got countless examples, whether it's my children asking me, a friend sending me a photo of a beetroot hummus saying, do I need to stop eating this? Is it ultra-processed food? There's confusion out there. We all work in the industry, and we're a little bit confused. Well, I certainly am. So we just need to bring it back to balanced diet. We know kind of what's good going in and how that's going to help. And formulating that, we've all been around a long time. We've seen the fad diets come and go. So if we just bring it back to that, because I agree, things like the Nova system is really clunky. HFSS doesn't work, but the nutrition of products doesn't lie ultimately. And the confusion comes because we've got loads of people overlaying even more classification now as well. Like, it was lovely of Zoe to come out and say that our Vadas kimchi is the best processed food. It's a good processed food. How confusing is that? It's a green processed food. This doesn't help the end consumer because all they want is healthy, accessible food. So I think we just need to try and simplify it, if that's at all possible.
Thank you. And Giles, when you're working within the eating behaviour, how are you finding, or is there any difference within ultra-processed foods and other foods within that category? How people are eating them, how they're behaving around them?
I mean, undoubtedly, there is, once again, within the broad umbrella of ultra-processed foods, there are foods that are really hyper-palatable. Mm-hmm. Okay, what I mean, because ultimately, ultra-processed foods, because they're industrially processed, are constructed foods. And you're going to construct them, you're going to want to make sure you put flavor, you're going to want to make sure it tastes nice, because ultra-processing in of itself removes a lot of flavor. And so they are hyper-palatable in that sense. And a group of them in particular, certainly in studies, RCTs, randomized controlled trials, do show that people eat more of them. But that is a percentage of the ultra-processed foods. The moment you begin to sort of back away and begin to look at the whole umbrella of what it actually is covering, you're talking about bread, 50% of ultra-processed foods are bread, okay? Or at least a pastry bread, all the prepackaged bread. So there's a whole discussion there. And then a lot of them are going to be drinks as well. So ultimately, I think we need better definition of the ultra-processed foods before we can actually get better answers about what is going to be, what is driving this hyper-palatability. Is it additives? Once again, what are we talking about, right? Are we talking about emulsifier? Are we talking about E-numbers? Are we talking about, you know, long lists of ingredients? Once again, I don't know what that means. And then the thing that annoys me the most, if your grandma doesn't recognize it, then it's bad for you. Once again, that's another terrible metric for what should or should not be good for you. So ultimately, it is down to making sure we have a better ruler, okay, in terms of just measuring something. We need to know what we're measuring, and what we're measuring is meaningful for the health of the consumer. And at the moment, it is too grey for a lot of the studies that are out there.
Thank you. I'm going to come back onto the categorization in a moment, because I think there's many, many categorizations and they seem to be fusing, which is making it even more complicated. But just on the nutrient side of it, I'm going to come back to yourself, Rob. How do you feel with foods, especially if you're communicating with foods that are ultra processed that then had fortification, or whether they've been processed to remove? How do you describe that to perhaps when you're communicating?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is everybody's been quite brainwashed, so it's really hard to talk about this. And like Giles, if I try and talk about this, straight away I'm accused of working with the food industry, and I've done it on TV, I've done it on radio. It's always the same. The abuse I get, you know, simply trying to say that you have to use your common knowledge. Baked beans, brown bread, hummus, a tomato cooking sauce, these are not unhealthy foods. They're really healthy. They're not hyperpalatable. They've maybe got one additive, and that one additive is consumed in smaller amounts. You know, as part of a balanced diet, it's totally fine to eat these foods. And I think that's where, for me, it's just so hard to translate that, because people have been listening to influencers. They're listening to that stupid frigging seed oil debate that's been going on for God knows how long about, you know, it's just ridiculous. So I think that, for me, it's just trying to re-educate people. And I think there's these healthy UPFs. Some people accuse them of sitting in this grey area for the food industry to kind of justify UPFs. But I don't think that's right. I think they're perfectly healthy. And I think they're the ones you should be including in your diet.
Thank you. So I'm going to come to Anthony to the other end now, and I'm going to ask you about the categorization system. So again, just so that we're kind of on a similar page. So the UPF debate obviously has been around for quite some time. There's about six or seven different categories, but the Nova category or Nova classification is the one that seems to have grabbed the biggest attention into those four different categories. So how do you feel, or whether you have an opinion about the Nova category? Do you think that it should be layered with things like the NPM score, Or do you think they should all just be got rid of and people be told it's a junk food or a good food?
I would get, I don't like the Nova categorization system. For people who don't know it, I mean, I can't give you a detailed description here from my head, but it's basically four categorization systems, from unprocessed to ultra processed. And the idea of this system is that things that sit into the ultra processed category are particularly bad and a driving sort of ill health in populations for sort of a seemingly complex set of reasons involving additives and hyperpalatability and various things. I think it's very unclear. I think it's very unhelpful. It drops a lot of perfectly healthy foods, as has been said, into that category, which is supposedly, I don't know, harmful. Is that what we're saying? I think it's really unhelpful. And really problematic. So I wouldn't sort of say it needs more nuance. I would say it's not a good approach. It's something created in 2016 at a brainstorming session in a Brazilian university, and apparently is then categorizes all the food in the world forevermore into how healthy it is. And I just don't believe that's a helpful way to proceed. We have nutrient profiling models and an HFSS, which I think is probably better. I don't think it's perfect at all. I think there's all sorts of things, and that can be extremely confusing for consumers and for food manufacturers, actually. But I think we need to work with that and work harder. What I do think as well is that we need these sort of categorization systems as a tool for policy and as a tool to help manufacturers and retailers sell a healthier mix of food. I don't necessarily think we need them as tools to tell consumers, don't eat that, it's terrible, because I don't think that's a helpful way to perceive how healthy it is. Something is depends on context. So I really don't like that idea of telling people, don't eat that, it's bad, don't eat Kit Kats or whatever. Well, people like them and they're okay in context and they're fine now and again. So I'm really always very cautious about saying, if this food's bad, this food's good, because I think that way madness and bad communication and disordered eating and all those sort of things lie. So I think these are tools for policy and these are tools for manufacturers and people like me to make healthier food.
And Matthew, when you're looking at the different models, do you feel that for your creating your products or labelling your products, would combining categorizations work or help?
I think it's important to overlay them all. I think there was an interesting report from Nesta recently that overlaid Nova with HFSS, and I think it was 60-65% of high HFSS products were regarded as ultra processed. I think all of these things are interesting, but are they going to help us deliver some healthier outcomes? So I think it's more around that kind of deliciousness side of things. Also, we've spent a lot of time at Compleat making sure our technical and product development team are educated to deal with the nuances of these conversations, because as I've said, that there's different views on this. We get very different views from every single retailer we deal with. We know that in our brands that we can look after these things ourselves. So we try and be as good as we can possibly be. Something like Squeaky Bean, for instance, the plant-based area has been unfairly vilified for being ultra-processed. It's been really targeted. There's been a stack load of misinformation about Frankenfood, and it comes back again to, as part of a balanced diet, meat mimetics are actually good for you, basically. So, it helps. There's a Lancet report that puts that to bed. So I think it's important to overlay this, but ultimately we've got to give the tools. We've tried to engage with, well, we have engaged with Camden to help us with our ingredients. But again, everybody gets into a place where they'll take the Nova system and let's have a 3A and a 3B and a 3C. And it's like, no, we need to make this simple. So I think it comes back to educating the team to make good decisions throughout that process. We know in plant-based, fortify the products, basically. That's one of the key things that can help somebody who's eating plant-based. So it's just the education around that.
Thank you. And Leo, within your sector, would you find that those different combinations of categories work or help?
Well, we've just chosen to ignore them because they don't work. They're not helping anything. And what we've discovered is that once you step outside that, and I agree that kind of some of what Zoe's doing seems to be counterproductive, but they too are operating outside the standard definitions. And what we're finding is that consumers are very hungry for that dialogue. So it's what we call the difference between a front-of-pack dialogue with a consumer and a back-of-pack dialogue with a consumer. And obviously, that's a euphemism, that it's actually about the, that they don't look at the health claims anymore on the front or take them seriously because they believe that they don't mean anything. They look for, in our case, a challenger brand, and I think this is a call to challenger brands to move into this space because they can in a way that large brands find much harder. So we just ignore the classifications and find that actually it's a very healthy place to be and a very enriching place to be with a consumer dialogue. I mean, for example, we're selling triple forecast, in the retailers already. Repeat purchase is amazing. And why would any consumer give bread a 5-star rating? And the only reason they would, because no bread deserves 5 stars, is because there's an emotional connection that people believe it's speaking to them and their families, more importantly. So I just think, I keep saying the same thing, I'm afraid, that actually we're measuring the wrong things. We're caught up in a debate that is not going anywhere. No one can win it. And the only way we can deal with it is to go upstream and find out. I mean, it's Desmond Tutu, wasn't he? Said, there comes a time when we've got to stop pulling people out of the river. We've got to go upstream and find out why they're falling in. And that's what we need to do now, in our view. And that's what I believe we are doing and working with other brands to do that now. So we spent the last 15 months backed by Innovate to move all of the kind of qualities from Superloaf into a dozen other food categories. And that's just come to an end. So we're now ready to take our platform technology, which is all based around nutrient density as a concept. And of course, nutrient density can only be possible with nutrient diversity simultaneously into other food categories. And we're talking to DEFRA and people like that. We're talking to the Food Standards Agency and what have you. And we are determined that this should become a sort of economic growth opportunity for UK PLC and just move out of the UPF debate. Sorry, I'm just repeating what I keep saying, so sorry about that.
That's super. Actually, I was just kind of thinking as you were saying that about M&S, kind of really pulling back on their ingredients because they thought that would appeal. And yet it seems to really have opened up another can of worms, which nicely then kind of pulls us back in. I'm going to pose this question to you, Giles, is that within lots of research at the minute, it's posing whether there should be more labels on the front of pack. And I don't know if we have enough room on labels to keep adding them. But how would you feel of that, particularly within South America and how we are adopting those as a public health strategy?
The problem is not an information problem, okay? Because all the information is there. The problem is, A, they're in font zero, and with me, you need a bright enough light to see it. The issue is not the amount of information. There's too much information at the back. Okay, that's not true. Put the information there. You're highlighting the wrong information, I think, ultimately. So I do like a traffic light system, because ultimately there are... One of you said there is reason. For food manufacturers, you need a certain set of rules so that you understand what the hell is going on. The consumer wants to walk in and out of the supermarket as quickly as possible and feed their family as best as possible. Ultimately, that's what it is. And so you cannot put more information on there and expect anyone in their right mind with 3 screaming kids, in their trolley to move in and out. So you need to make things easier for people to try and make the right decisions. So a traffic light system works. We just need to highlight the right types of things in a shortcut manner to ensure that people by default, or at least by just a glance, will have a general idea what they're buying. So more information, to my mind, for the consumer is not necessarily the right answer.
And does anyone else have any other views?
Yeah, I think rolling it back up again, let's make sure that we promote more healthy food, because I still think the stats on the promotion of fruit and vegetables in retail is minuscule compared to unhealthier items. So I think there are other things that we can do without coming back to the packaging side of things. I also think anyone who works in product development and innovation, we need to, you know, we've been carrying this around for a long time. Let's stop developing some of these products and let's start developing things that are more nutrient dense, that are healthier. And I think maybe that'll be the unintended consequence of this period, that hopefully it frees up and we have like a proper debate about health rather than, you know, labeling and nutritional profile scores and traffic lights and all of these things.
Can I just jump in very, very quickly? I'm sorry, just thinking to the previous session, I was here for the previous session, and someone actually brought up these new anti-obesity drugs, these incretin-based drugs. Just one sentence about this. And I did an event in which there was a broader conversation about the moment you get real penetration of these drugs into the community, we can debate these drugs later, but if at all, what happens to the actual food industry? Now, these drugs make you eat fuller, so you eat less. Is there an opportunity, because people are eating less, to then increase the nutrient density of foods within the construct? Because these drugs, like the UPFs, these drugs are not going to go away, right? And so hence, if there is a reason and a push to sort of redevelop some of the foods where if it's in a world where a percentage of society are now going to eat less, can we make them more nutrient dense? So I think there is some synergies to that. Sorry.
It's fun. It would be great if we could talk about that, because Giles probably knows more than anyone here about the new generation of anti-obesity drugs. And I think they're important. I think we're slightly asleep on that in the food industry. But what I'd say about UPFs is, in front of pack communication, is, you know, the one thing policymakers don't know much about how to make people eat more of different foods. It's a very difficult thing for them to do. And so you get fairly sort of boring and actually completely ineffective policies like front-of-pack labelling. There's plenty of research showing that front-of-pack labelling doesn't really affect purchase decisions. The people who do know a lot about persuading consumers to eat certain things are partly brands, but mostly retailers. And so I think it's really, we need to, if we want to really shape food and create a better food system, we need to be using the power of the retailers to shape the mix of products that people are buying. And we define that by, you know, lots of good science. But you know, that's what we really need to be doing. And policy needs to be directed towards retailers to use levers to make them change the mix of people's buying, promote more fruit and vegetables, promote more healthier foods, because they're the guys who know how to change consumer decisions and are very good at it. So that's kind of where I feel that policy needs to lie, rather than this sort of blame onto the consumer, you know, telling them off for eating badly.
Well, kind of news from the front line is that most of the retailers do understand all of this, and they are pushing for change, and they're finding the problem area is trying to persuade food manufacturers to implement the changes they're looking for. They're resistant, and I think actually what M&S have just recently done, I mean, they've been derided about the one ingredient products and so forth, and I can understand that, but I think what everybody overlooks, what they have achieved, is they've made a food industry do something they said they couldn't. And I think that's a seismic shift that they've done. And that's because they own their own recipes. And so they can do it in a way that other retailers can't. But they've shown the industry can adapt and do things that it says it can't. And I know the FDF were here yesterday, but they don't help with all of this because they resist change. But also, I don't think it's the food manufacturer's responsibility to be driving this change either. You know, the food industries, we hear about today, it's about trends and flavors and things like that. It's not the food industry's job to reframe the food system and to redesign it. So, you know, there's a gap here. It needs innovators and it needs innovation and it needs policy as well. But the retailers are absolutely crucial to this.
Do you think as well that innovation needs to filter down to be cost effective though as well? Because it's all right having these cornflakes with four ingredients in M&S, but they're not being sold in local corner shops or Lidl or these places where people on lower budgets go. So I think the innovation really needs to provide healthy food made from, you know, grains, pulses, beans, convenient, whatever it is, but at a price point that everybody can afford. Because the problem is all this innovation just produces these health products that are aimed at the wellness sort of area of society, which can afford to do it. So yeah, that needs to filter through to make it more affordable.
I think innovation is important. I work in innovation, so I probably would say that. But I also think if you go in any supermarket now, there's plenty of healthy products there. It's not like we need more, you know. I think there are healthy products available. It's kind of directing people towards them, promoting them more than promoting sort of less healthy products. So I think, you know, I think that's why I think the retailer thing is so important, because, you know, there's a world of healthy foods in every supermarket.
And that's why we need to change the guidelines. You know, they are what need to change. So the nutrient profiling model needs to either evolve or be changed into something else that recognizes that. So we've spent the last 3 decades taking things out of the food system. So a health minus era, where anything that's been deemed as unhealthy gets taken out and replaced by something else. And it does not work. It has not worked, has not had an effect on public health. The, you know, the socioeconomic cost to the UK of poor diet is £360 billion. You know, it dwarfs the size of the food industry. So if we move into what we call a health plus era, where we're putting goodness into the food system, but to do that, we then need to count it. It needs to be counted by some method. So the current nutrient profiling model does not recognize gut health. It does not recognize micronutrients, or it calls all fibers one thing. Fibers can be anything from a 1 out of 10, or in fact a -5 out of 10, to a +10. And yet they're still called just, that's one unit of fiber. And it's ludicrous. So that's what needs to be fixed. And then we won't have to have this debate, because it'll just be, there's a score that works instead of something that's 30 years old.
I think going back to what you're saying before, you know, when you're busy, might have children, you're going to the supermarket. We're all creatures of habit. You know, we kind of might make a lovely shopping list, but we go and buy the same things. How would you begin to initiate change, particularly for those that are really struggling financially? And they seem to get burdened with the, you know, they're the ones that perhaps are going to be overweight. They're the ones that are perhaps going to be hit by it. And yet they're the ones that are trying to feed their children. So I'm going to pose that to Giles.
I think the only way to do that is remove equitably. Okay, obviously there are worried well, there are wellness people. And that's almost a different sector of society. Okay, but I think for people in the lower socioeconomic status, and remember that the bottom quintile socioeconomically is twice as likely to end up with diet-related illnesses, all diseases probably, but diet-related illnesses than everyone in this room. Okay, I think the default option, if you've got a tenner to feed your family, okay, and you go in, the default option, because you have fewer choices, should be healthy. Okay, whatever healthy means, but it should be healthy. This might mean moving where you subsidize things. This might mean any number of different things. And I don't mean healthy like buying carrots. I understand like carrot is healthy, but within each sector of food that you want to have, there's fruit and vegetables, there's a chocolate bar because sometimes you need a chocolate bar, there's a frozen lasagna because sometimes you need a frozen lasagna. So each sector, you need, when you have the least amount of money, to be the most healthy that you can get for each thing. That's the only way we're going to tackle this equitably. Because the moment you have to think about it, you always only go by price point. That's the answer. So it's got to be default that the cheapest is by default healthy.
Yeah. I think as well, though, we're all talking about foods that you can buy sort of ready-made, ready-prepared, but people need to understand how to cook. Yeah. There's a lack of understanding how to cook, how to budget, the food literacy. We need to educate people more on how they can actually cook on a budget. Because you can make a meal for 4 people or the 5 if you really want to, using beans, pulses, lentils. So I think somewhere in this conversation needs to be that point that we need to educate people more, yeah. Feed themselves.
And is that also...
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to help. We've got 5,000 employees, and whether you work in the boardroom or on the factory floor, how you eat healthily is really, really important. So I think just that education side of things is missing, because it's really lovely to go and buy a jar of beans for $4.99, but you can get a lot of beans out of a kilo for a long time. So that education thing is key, helping people to cook simple, healthy recipes is key to this as well, because, you know, they don't talk about it in school anymore. It's just it's a non-conversation. So, you know, we're going to have to kind of help fill those gaps as well as all of the others.
But at scale, I mean, I agree with all of that. I mean, that's it's criminal that isn't taking place. But at scale, I think it has to be health by stealth. And the only way you can have health by stealth is through high-intensity nutrition, because just the natural fiber in a natural ingredient is not enough to move the dial, and it gets in the way of processing and stuff. So you have to find ways to concentrate things through synergies and fermentation and other things like that in order to get the impact high enough to be able to make health by stealth.
How do you find that with keeping the costs down as well, something we're trying to do, well, keep it accessible?
We see it in all sorts of technology, because this is a technology we're talking about. This isn't, you know, kitchen stuff. This is lab stuff. But by the way, it's all, Superloaf is a clean label product, and our blend, our intervention, has antimicrobial qualities naturally in it from the fermentation that give it a phenomenal shelf life. But I forgot your question. I'm so focused.
Hey, how we can implement it without kind of having such a cost burden?
Yeah, well, we've seen it with other technologies. Sorry, like electric vehicles and so forth. I mean, if you don't bring in the the influencers to start with, I don't mean social media influencers, but transformation has to have transition. And so these are transitional things where there will be cost differentials happening along the way, but we just have to believe in the system and capitalism or whatever, that it will, if the right thing is being done and backed by government who want economic growth, that it will filter down through. And by the way, you know, I mean, our latest blend is half the price of the current one that's in, you know, in Superloaf, for example. So I think a lot can be done. A precision fermentation is going to come into this hugely in terms of creating units of nutrition. We're working with Oxford University now about defining a unit of nutrition, because one doesn't exist, and then work back from that. So how can you create that potentially? And I know a lot of people will feel uncomfortable about that, but you know, there is nothing fundamentally wrong with that if it's done in the right way.
Thank you. After we've got about 10 minutes or so left of about 8 minutes of conversation. I'm going to open up some questions. We can't go anywhere without talking about GLP-1. That was one on our list that we really want to talk about. But no, in a really good way. We want to talk about it. Because what I want to pose the question, I'm going to pose it to all of you, but I'm going to start with Charles. And you may not think that this is a disruptor, but what do you think is going to be the disruptor of ultra-processed foods or just consumption of high-fat sugar salt, because surely it's volume rather than the foods individually.
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So this same event that I actually went to, and I hadn't actually quite, I think about the biology of these drugs, how they work, that's what I study. I attended an event in which, to a bunch of investors, okay, and they were interested in what happens, and they were modeling it. They were saying, okay, if these drugs reach X percent of the people who have diseases, how would this affect this many people? I saw the graphs. It was really quite interesting, at 10%, 20%, 30% penetration. And they were looking at the US market. And what happened was these drugs make you feel fuller. You feel fuller, you eat less, you lose weight. All right. But they only make you feel fuller. So in other words, if your diet wasn't great to begin with, it'll just make you eat less of a good diet. And so there's a big push now to actually understand that dietary interventions are applied along these drugs, and it means there is an opportunity for food manufacturers, okay, to actually say, not say this is your GLP-1 conflict, that's not what I mean, but to actually now think about, well, what are we going to do? People tend to spend around the same amount on food, right? What are we going to take with that unit of spend, wherever you are socioeconomically spending on food, and how can we shoehorn in more nutrition as people actually eat less? So in other words, you can then say, okay, this unit of price, we can invest it into something else like nutritional density or what have you, because people tend to spend the same amount on food. And so this was an interesting way of actually thinking about how the two sectors, the weight loss sector, the health sector, is going to be with the food manufacturers.
I was also kind of just thinking, whilst you're saying that, maybe that can work really well with older adults that don't have a huge amount of appetite. So it could be a really nice way of getting in nutrient-dense portions.
And one other quick thing about, not only do you need to improve your diet on these drugs because they just make you feel fuller, if you rapidly lose weight, you will always lose both fat mass, which is what we all signed up for, and lean mass, right? Unless always. This is not specific to these drugs. So there needs to be a couple of things. Obviously, you need to increase your physical activity while on the drugs to mitigate against that. But then you need to make sure your protein content is right as well as you're eating. So I think there are a number of moving parts that we need to consider as eating behavior changes, driven by policy or driven by pharmaceuticals, driven by these drugs, that the food industry need to be ahead of. And actually need to consider, well, okay, as we're developing foods and classes of foods, what do we need to think about these influences? Not, once again, not the social media influences, yeah, but the broader influences.
Yeah. Even mentioning, I say, from social media influences, I was talking about the BDA the other day, and they're saying, you know, nutritionists, dietitians, academics are generally not influencers. And so there's that big, big gap, and we need to kind of maybe get more of them to be influencers. So hopefully they can spread the word a little bit more. So just before we wrap up, if I could just take, you know, final thoughts really from you. Where do you think the ultra-processed food debate is still going to rage on if we will come back in 10 years? Or as you were saying earlier, Leo, did you think that we're kind of just dragging it back and we need to let go of it and concentrate on the next level? So I'm going to start with you, Leo.
I mean, I don't think we have any choice. I think we've got to untangle this, and I think we will untangle it. So I think in 10 years' time, my prediction is that nutrient density, it may have changed its definition or wording by that time, but it's what we know of now, and that actually grant givers are funding now using that terminology. I think that will come to predominate and not completely solve a problem, but largely solve a problem that we're beating ourselves up at the moment.
And Anthony?
Oh, okay. I obviously, we are still going to be debating how to define whether foods are healthier or not. My hope is that UPF will kind of have moved on and we'll be looking at slightly more nuanced and interesting definitions and more effective policy behind behind them. And yeah, I think that there's some fundamentals we don't know, and we probably need academics and we need institutes to be really looking at that, especially on GLP-1s, to understand how that affects people's reactions and sensory understanding of the sensory properties of food, because I think there is an influence, and lots of stuff we don't know. We're kind of scrambling around a bit in the dark. So yeah, I think we'll still be debating it, but my hope is we'll have moved on from the actual UPF and the NOVA classification to something that makes more sense.
And Rob?
Yeah, I think I agree with these guys. I think the same thing. Hopefully we've got more kind of bold evidence-based policy that's pushing us in the right direction. And I hope that we just have a more society that's more food literate, understands how to feed themselves a bit better.
Fantastic. And Matthew?
Yeah, totally agree with everything that's been said. And I think, as I said earlier, if the unintended consequence of this is to push health up the agenda a little bit more, and let's have a conversation about following the Live Well diet, linking your own health with that of the planet's, and making sure that we're all aware of the opportunities there to drive that nutrient density, to have a play around with food. I do think the innovation side of things, we've got a job to do to make things delicious, firstly, but also on the health side. But I think I only look at this positively. I'd love to leave the UPF debate. A few of us were at Ascot not that long ago, all thinking it was going to die a death, and it's come back bigger and badder and with sharper teeth. So I don't think it's ever going to go away, but we need to countenance it with some sensible action.
It's been an absolute pleasure to host the session. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Ascot in October and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. in September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com.